I don't like writing about the dead, conjuring them in language some of them never would have used, pushing them on stage saying, go. It doesn't have to be the truth.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Arkansas poet Joe McDougall. Her newest collection, The Undiscovered Room, published by Tavern Books, invites readers into the small towns of the rural South and Midwest, inhabited by grief, resignation, awe, and death.
And joy, I hope, and even some gossip. Nobody wants to be a ghost. It's tiresome being noticed but never seen.
The Undiscovered Room, poet Joe McDougall, and a world of privation, buoyed up by dreams on Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with poet Joe McDougall. She is the author of several collections of poetry, as well as Daddy's Money, a memoir of farm and family. Her collected poems, In the Home of the Famous Dead, was published in 2015 by the University of Arkansas Press. Her most recent collection, The Undiscovered Room, was published in 2016 by Tavern Books.
It's tiresome being noticed but never seen. How else can one go back, though, to the house that was sold or burned or rotted away? To rustle the blinds, startle the cat, walk barefoot out for the morning paper?
Joe McDougall, poet who believes in E.E. Cummings' line,
love is thicker than forget.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
I must admit that I'm a fan. I love the clarity of your incandescent lines.
Well, that's what I love to hear.
Now sit right down. I'm gonna tell you a story about a man who used to be.
I hope the lines are clear, but I also hope that they're somewhat mysterious.
So there is mystery in your poetry.
Uh-huh.
Tell us a little bit about your sense of mystery.
Well, to me, I think all poets sense this, that behind even the most familiar things, there is something we can't quite ever know. And as a poet, we're trying to get at it. We're trying to see what is the hidden life of a cat or a vase of roses or the silence in a room can mean something to us. Then we try to convey.
The Undiscovered Room seems to me such a mature collection, a careful coalescence of your life's work, a coming together of so many of the themes you've previously explored. Farm life, ghosts, sweet contrivances, and stillness falling like calamity.
Well, thank you. I'm not through exploring. I'm looking now more extensively into that stillness and that mystery that you just asked me about, those moments of awe and wonder that I think we forget in our busy world to look for those things. But the world brings those things to you, like when you step out onto a lawn in the moonlight, or when a flash of memory overtakes you and you're stunned, things like that.
And this book's also a lot about memory.
It certainly is. I mean, that's what poets rely on.
The Undiscovered Room is divided into four sections.
Rustling the Blinds is the first one. Important Bones, Sweet Contrivances, Stillness Falling Like Calamity.
Why did you set it up into sections like this?
When I read a poetry book, I really like to have it divided up into sections because it gives me a little bit of a clue as to what the writer is thinking about those sections. And then I tried to group the poems into the sections that they fit. For instance, Rustling the Blinds is about memory. Important Bones is about loss and death. Sweet Contrivances has, I hope, some whimsical poems. And Stillness Falling Like Calamity is about, well, it's about stillness and silence. And the titles of the sections are taken from lines in the poems that are in the sections.
So in the first poem in the collection, it's called Away with Mules.
Yeah.
You speak directly to the reader.
Yeah. Well, I don't usually do that, but it just seemed to work in this poem. I don't usually ask rhetorical questions in a poem. I'm always afraid somebody will answer in the negative. So I don't usually do that, but I thought it worked here. Shouldn't you, reader, be led to see these glossy, passionate, stumping souls who once plowed a field in the teeth of a tornado, waltzed with a wooden leg, sashayed an armadillo on a leash? My teacher and friend Miller Williams had a wonderful saying. He used to say, well, if it isn't true, it ought to be. And here I think it could be.
Did you see tornadoes when you were
Yes, there? I did. One almost came into the dining room through the plate glass window of the farmhouse I was living in. And often, Charles and I and the children, we lived on a farm after I got married, and we would often get in the pickup and outrun the tornado, which might not have been the best idea.
They do have teeth.
They do. Perhaps not. Perhaps you've already left the page, dealing with your own ghost, throwing them over your shoulder like salt. A cousin, a brother missing in action, who smoked every day a pack of Camels and had a way with mules.
Tell us about this.
Well, in this poem, because I start out with my own thoughts, as the narrator is talking about the I of the poem, I don't like talking about the dead, etc. But then towards the end, when I bring the reader in and say, perhaps you're dealing with your own ghost, that brings the reader in. So it begins with the individual, but it ends with the universal.
So I know you wrote a memoir. It's mm-hmm. called Daddy's Money, A Memoir of Farm and Family. Tell us about your daddy and the farm and family.
Well, I wrote the memoir about growing up on a rice farm in southern Arkansas. And my father was a rice farmer. And his father was a pioneer in rice farming in Arkansas County. My grandfather was an immigrant from Belgium who bought land near DeWitt and began farming it about, I'd say, 1904, 1906. And I had a very happy childhood on the farm, which can be a detriment to a writer. And so when I started writing the memoir, I know you have to have conflict in any kind of writing. And I thought, well, I had a happy childhood. What do I do? But the more I wrote, the more I remembered many unhappy things, many conflicting things, many confusions that all children have.
So what were your days like growing up on a rice farm?
I had a lot of freedom. I had solitude. I could walk barefoot in the dirt and dust in the summer. And I was just walking around talking to myself, telling myself stories, counting out the sentences on my fingers for the stresses. I guess I was supposed to be a poet.
So when did you start writing poetry?
The first poem I wrote and showed to anyone, I was 12. And it was a terrible poem about dew on the grass. But I showed it to my father, and he framed it and put it on his desk. And since all writers have a great ego, that just started me on my way.
So this poem isn't necessarily about your father, but it seems to be.
I'd say it is.
Okay.
Bringing in the sheaves.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's 1945. The crops laid by in October, if he was lucky. By Thanksgiving, if not. My father would throw his hat into the threshing machine with the final shock of rice from the final field.
Would your own father do that with his hat?
He did. It was a tradition then among farmers. My husband's father, who was a farmer, did that too. And they used threshing machines then where you could see the grain being taken in on a belt, and actually you could see the chaff coming out from the grain. And so they would throw their hats into that threshing machine, and the belt would take it. And it was sort of like a primitive ritual where that hat was eaten, really, by the machine, and that was the end of harvest. So it was a celebration. That one moment of the year, he was jubilant, cocky even, winning out over creditors and blackbirds and rot.
There were challenges.
Yeah, those were the real challenges for my father. The blackbirds would eat the grain before he could get it out of the field, because then in the era of the threshing machine, the stalks of rice were put into shocks, bundles, and they had to sometimes wait for days to get it out of the field. And so that not only were the blackbirds there, but the chance of rot, and then your crop was very much diminished. Then the December rains, the hunger for rattling machinery, for sweat, for missing crews, wasted months of accounting and tinkering. He would have cut off his thumb and buried it had he thought that would hasten spring. Then spring, when laying his plow to the insolent dirt, he began again. You know, a farmer's got to love the dirt. He's got to love growing things. He's got to follow the seasons. Otherwise, he could never put up with the gamble. He's got to hope. He's got to persist.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arkansas poet Joe McDougall read and talk about her book, The Undiscovered Room.
A fair day. Today we lay my mother in her grave. A fair day. Spring clanking its old cliches, a willow stammering into leaf, lawns stupefied with green.
Tell us about your mom.
My mother was a big believer in books and education. She was the first of her family really to finish high school, and then she went on to college. And of course, I was born during the Great Depression that was still lingering in Arkansas. And mother bought a set of books from me from some traveling person, and they really couldn't afford it. But she read to me from those books every night, and they had poems, they had stories, they had wonderful illustrations. And she was a tremendous influence on my becoming a writer, although that wasn't her intention. She simply wanted me to do well in school and have a leg up.
Did she read your poems?
Mother died right after the first book was out, and she did read it, and she was very proud of me, but she said, "Honey, they're really good, but they don't rhyme." That's what she had been taught in school, was poems had to rhyme. My mother's perfume crumples the air, and I am five again. Spring, an undiscovered room, glimpsed through the scrim of her hair as she bends to help me tie my Sunday shoes.
From this poem comes the title.
The title of the book. Because I thought the title might bring up for a reader his or her own undiscovered rooms and mysteries that they would think about theirs. The soloist sings Rock of Ages, my mother's favorite hymn. The preacher lays down words like cutlery on a table.
So the title of the second section of your book is called Important Bones. Who constitute these important bones?
And that comes from a poem about a cat, and it's called In Due Time. And in the poem, the cat has lost his molars, and he no longer can break the important bones of birds. So that's a line in the poem. In due time, the vet has removed the cat's infected molars and left him to his bliss. He will sleep through today and tomorrow. Then food and naps in his own time. The front step, then the yard, where he will find his old self, as the bed has promised, although no longer able to break the important bones of birds. Well, I thought that the cat's loss is a metaphor for all of us, that, you know, these kinds of losses that leave us stunned and powerless, even if it's only for a moment. And sometimes, of course, the losses last forever.
Don't close your eyes. Give me a moment, Lord. These ways stay alive.
At the Sunny Day Cafe, I order coffee and watch a fly dance itself close to death on the windowsill. I think of my daughter dying, her breath a noisy braiding of air. That was a day in March, the 21st day. The sun dissolves behind a cloud. The fly, magnificent now, sizzles.
I think this is my favorite poem.
Thank you.
In the book.
Thank you.
It's just such a stark juxtaposition between the cafe, which mm-hmm. is sunny, and the daughter.
Right.
And it's so sad, but not completely sad.
No, not completely. It is at the Sunny Day Cafe. But that juxtaposition is deliberate. That's for irony. That's why I chose the title, The Sunny Day Cafe.
Your daughter did die, didn't she?
Yes, she died at the age of 42, and she left behind four teenagers. But she was a joyous person and was very hopeful up to the end and very much for her children and trying to give her children a normal life while she had cancer. The cancer lasted quite a while. She amazed the doctors that she got so many years. Talking with my dead daughter. Why do my words fall apart whenever I describe you? I was the one fate chose to keep you alive, to make the air remember. Now and then, minutes, seconds go by. I don't think of you. I failed at grief. When you lose a child, no matter if it's not your fault, you feel guilty. You feel there's something you could have done. And then if you're not grieving enough in your mind, you think you have failed at it. And I also thought it was a kind of a twist on the normal thoughts about grief.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're visiting with poet Jo McDougall as she talks about sweet contrivances.
Well, I like to have a little whimsy in all my books. And this is a poem called Housewifery. It isn't simple. It never was. Running a household with hamsters, a python, a parakeet, a husband, kids, and now my husband wants to bring home a pig. Clean as a whistle, he vows. You'll never know she's around.
This didn't actually happen.
No, husband did not bring home a pig, but he might have. And when I wrote the poem, I was thinking of an old 17th century word where housewifery is spelled huswifery. And that's always fascinated me how that was spelled. And the words meant a lot of things through the ages. But, of course, now when we think of housewife, it's the menial tasks that the woman has to do. And now the last straw pig. And he says, you'll never know she's around, but I will. She'll make demands. She'll want marinated peelings, bone china, her own room. And won't she be a fine one to collect flies? So this poor housewife is going to have a lot more on her plate now, keeping a clean house. I can see it now. In those 5-minute mornings I call my own as I'm having coffee on the deck. She'll plunk herself down at my desk, admiring her pedicure, rifling through my mail.
Tell us about those five-minute mornings. I bet you do have those.
I do, when I possibly can, with my cup of coffee out on my patio now. I don't have a pig to distract me.
Was this one of those sweet contrivances, this poem?
I think so. I think the whimsical moments are the sweet contrivances, and also the things that the world brings that you didn't expect, like a catalpa blossom falls on your toe as you're walking.
I sit alone here every night. Sometimes I cry, dear. Won't get in a fight.
That's a sweet contrivance that the world contrived to bring you something and to make you pay attention. Ceremony. When his wife left, he married the cat. The courtship was solemn, carried on by the cat. She'd been on the fringes, forgotten.
Looking out the window.
Discovered, forgotten again.
In the air.
And now the rooms were silent.
Smell your tears.
And the man would not speak, but sat flat-footed in his chair.
And I swear, soon I'll be home forever.
Then he accepted her tentative paw across his shoe.
With my dreams, my love.
Then she climbed onto his lap,
my dreams,
crept under the evening paper.
Why the two thens?
For time passing. These were in stages that the cat was courting the man.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to poet Joe McDougall as she talks about stillness falling like calamity in her collection, The Undiscovered Room. Ernest Hemingway wrote much of A Farewell to Arms in Piggott, Arkansas, where he spent some time when married to his wife, Pauline Pfeiffer. The house, also known as the Pfeiffer House and Carriage House, is now an historic museum.
That's true. And I was invited there a few years ago to direct a writing workshop. And I got to go into Hemingway's studio, which is on the grounds. It was an unforgettable experience. You see a desk and you see a typewriter. And the typewriter is not original, but it really doesn't matter because you are in the same studio that Hemingway was in. And you just, I felt his presence.
So this poem is called
The Studio. I had heard of Hemingway's time in Piggott, Arkansas, a studio in a barn, a famous manuscript. Now, invited to these grounds, I enter the studio. November niggles the grass, the trees, as Hemingway stands at his typewriter, his back to me, paper scattered like lilies across a pond. You know, that studio was really powerful, the stillness of it, the fact that Hemingway actually was there. And then there's a collection on one wall of safari animals, because as we all know, Hemingway was a great trophy collector. And that was unforgettable, and I actually dreamed about it after my visit.
There's nothing left to say. Regrets only get in the way.
As he walks toward a wall where the heads of animals have come to die again, one, an impala, finds the rest of its body and slips it on, kicking the studio into a maelstrom of dust that moves like a gasp to slather Piggott, erasing the town square and the last evening train. You know, Piggott is a fascinating little town, and the train can be heard all over town. It's an enormous presence.
The last section of your book,
Stillness Falling Like right. Calamity,
seems to me a reflection on aging.
Well, it is, but I hope it's also a reflection on going forward. And the subject of age, when I'm writing, I don't think about how old I am. I'm just lost in the writing. So in a way, I can forget my age, but I'm still not through. Ambition, late life. No Alps are here, no gold, no Byzantium, no silver streets, only a few deer lifting their heads, then bowing to the grass.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Also, check out the supplemental section of the webpage for the show if you care to hear more of Joe McDougall. A special thank you to the remarkable musicianship and talent of Randall Shreve, who wrote the score as well as original music for this show. Thank you to the quiet talent of Mr. Chris Hickey, who helps us to produce these shows. I'm going out with the best of you. Never mind, close your ears, all the rest of you. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you, Arkansas poet Joe McDougall, whose lovely poems remind us to stop, to take notice, to take a breath.
Unable to sleep, she walks onto the lawn, cold and ivory under the moon. An owl makes its stiff noise. Something whispers across her feet. Stepping inside, she's caught in the lawn's slow spell. As if a swimmer drowned had been pulled to shore. A crowd gathering. Stillness falling like calamity. Brothers, sisters, can't you see we